the biggest thing that if everyone on the planet did this, I wouldn't have a job, is just stop beating yourself up about things. Stop criticizing yourself. Stop being harsh on yourself. Stop believing that motivating yourself with self-castigation is effective, because it isn't. You know, let yourself be you. You're improving all the time. Yep, you're making mistakes every day because that's what human beings do. But if you stop beating yourself up when you make a mistake, you learn the lessons that need to be learned and you just keep growing.
Welcome back. Today, I am joined by author and mind coach, Tim Box. Tim has done some fantastic work in the field of anxiety and has helped a lot of people manage those intrusive thoughts and not let it hinder their lives. Tim's TEDx speech has been viewed on YouTube over 1.2 million times. I really hope you enjoy the conversation. Let's get into it. So I was one of those 1.2 million people who viewed your TEDx speech. And nosily, I really wanted to know who you were before the speech and what got you into the field of anxiety. I mean, did you suffer with it? I mean, what led you on the path to becoming an author, a speaker, and a coach?
What got me into this line of work, it was a combination of things. The first thing, I suppose, most directly, was my own experience of dealing with anxiety. And then it was a desire to do something that was a bit more fulfilling than the plumbing career that I'd found myself embarked upon, and just do something that resonated with me a little bit more. So it was a mixture of the two. I think going into a therapeutic side of things was very much, okay, I want to find something that I'm going to enjoy doing, a journey I'm going to enjoy going on. And then I ended up specializing in anxiety. I think simply because, I don't know, if I guess it felt like I could relate to it a bit more and I understood it a bit better than some of the other things that I was dealing with. You know, you get into this professionally. So I'm a hypnotherapist by trade, and you start to see people who want to stop smoking and lose weight and change bad habits and things like that. And I was just starting to see increasing amounts of anxiety clients. And it just resonated with me because the things they were saying just reminded me of where I'd been, even probably without realizing it fully, that was what I was dealing with at the time. So it's almost like retrospectively that I realized, oh God, yeah, that's why I can relate to this. That's why I'm understanding what's going on, maybe a little bit better than most, because yeah, I've been there, you know.
So you said you'd been there. What was life like? Like, how did you cope with that anxiety, or how didn't you cope with it?
Well, this is the thing, and I want to claim that I had it as bad as other people have had it that I've spoken to and that I've worked with. But I'm aware that late in my youth, so I'm talking about, well, having always been what we might refer to as a nervous child, as the youngest of the family, I'd been brought up in a safe environment, but I'd always been kind of slightly introverted, maybe slightly more alone oriented, if that makes sense. And I think that made me struggle when it came to building my friendship groups at school. And it really kind of kicked off when I was in the later stages of my schooling. So I remember like what we used to call fifth form, and then lower sixth and upper sixth at my secondary school. I've no idea what it's called now, but you'd probably be able to tell me. But sort of, you know, 15, 16 years old.
Yeah.
And I experienced a modicum of bullying, that, you know, again, nothing really, you know, life-threatening or stuff that compared to what some others might have gone through, but certainly it disturbed me enough to make me feel extremely timid about engaging in groups. And that was when social anxiety kind of kicked in for me, and it extended into my university years and slightly beyond that as well, when I think about it, you know. And it was just a real kind of debilitating emotional response that stopped me, even though I desperately wanted to have a group of friends and really, you know, felt I belonged and just all of that sort of stuff. It just inhibited me from actually being comfortable with any of that process, and always thinking that I was the odd one out, always thinking I was the one that could easily just be disposed of in the friendship group and whenever I was part of a group, you know what I mean? And there was all those sorts of thoughts going on. It took me many years to what I would say get out the other side of the debilitating aspects of that as well.
So you mentioned it inhibited you during that time. And I think those who have anxiety, they can experience a thing called, you know, self-sabotaging themselves, because whatever triggers them, they'll self-sabotage it. And if it's, like you said, social anxiety, they might think, well, it's me. I shouldn't make friends. I'm not worthy, or tell themselves a story that's definitely untrue. So how did you navigate your way through those university years? And the reason I'm asking you that is because I think there's some people listening now might be going through some form of social anxiety because of maybe the pandemic. They've kind of been withdrawn for a few years, and they just might resonate really.
I think I was fortunate in as much as I wasn't aware that anxiety was a thing that you would go and see someone about. Yeah. And I'd probably say I wasn't using the term anxiety at that time in my life. You know, I was like nervous, worried, shy, insecure, all those sorts of things, stressed, that kind of thing. But anxiety wasn't a name I was giving it. It was just this feeling that stopped me. And navigating my way through it, you know, you get your safety protocols. You know, you don't put yourself in situations where you're going to suddenly feel like I'm in a room full of people, but I'm completely alone. You know, these days we get straight on our phones, don't we? And we're scrolling our phone, pretending we're doing something incredibly busy, just so it doesn't look like we're standing around like a fifth wheel waiting for someone to talk to us, you know. But when I was in groups, when I was at uni, I was just aware that I would probably largely avoid events and social situations just because I was inevitably going to end up with that uncomfortable, starting to feel isolated, standing in a room that's full of people and feeling completely alone, as if anything that I do, if I walk up and talk to anyone, they're going to ridicule me or reject me, things like that. And that was where I was. But the way I got through this, because I wasn't tied to any diagnosis, because I wasn't buying into the framework of an illness, as it were, in terms of the way it gets presented now, I always assumed, and I think this is the case, I think I always assumed I would, when I grew up, he says in inverted commas there, get through this, and I would come out the other side and start to be more like, I don't know, the adults that I saw in my life, like my dad or someone like that, who seemed very confident in groups of people. And I just assumed that when I graduate from this phase of my life, that will occur. And the reasons for that, I think I connected with as well. I know that at school, it was vitally important that I was accepted socially, because that was my world. You know, you go into school, your group of friends, your class group or your year group, that's the whole world. It's like a little microcosm. If you get rejected from that group, that's it. You're rejected from life as we know it. Yeah. And I recognized at some point that, hang on, I don't think the stakes are quite as high as they were when I developed this fear. Yeah, I think the stakes now have diminished greatly. I started to realize that when I didn't necessarily resonate with the people I was hanging out with, I probably found another group of people to hang out with. And you know, you realize that relationships can be slightly transient in as much as they come and go. And you hopefully connect with the people who you are like-minded with. And I just started to realize that, you know what, if these people in front of me don't like me, that's probably okay. That's not going to be the end of the world for me. And a number of different thoughts like that enabled me to connect with the bit of me that was crying out, that was terrified, and it enabled me to comfort and calm that part of me to the point where, I don't know, I guess I just started to get that confidence in, it's okay to be me. You know, I don't need to put on a front. I don't need to pretend to be like the person in front of me. I can just be me and probably have something to offer, you know?
Yeah. Was that the turning point then, when you realized that you are enough as you are, that you thought, okay, I can start controlling that?
Yeah, I think that's it. I think that has to be it, you know, because it's one thing to say, well, if these people in front of me don't like me, they're probably people that will like me. That's okay. That's a good thought as well. But I think the thought that helped me was that it doesn't matter if anyone likes me. You know, I am actually quite good on my own. I do quite like my own company. And I some of my, you know, most enjoyable times are when I'm just killing time in my own mind and my own thoughts, you know, and creating and stuff like that. And I realized that it wasn't necessarily, I'd been taught that I needed the big group of people, the gang, the tribe, because that's how it was when I was at school. But when I realized, you know, I don't need to go and find people who can fight my corner, because life isn't about winning your tribe over it. It probably is just about you living a happy and fulfilling life. So yeah, I totally realized that if a group rejects me, there'll be another group that accepts me for the same reasons that group rejected me as well. You know what I mean? But it doesn't matter if they don't. And I think when I realized I'm okay as me, you know, if I like me, that's all that needs to happen here, then it gave me some autonomy and also returned my agency in my journey, in that sense that I was now no longer simply victim to whatever other people thought of me.
I think that's one of the most empowering and important lessons you can ever have in your life, is knowing that you're enough and knowing that you don't have to conform to other people's ideas of what you should be doing. I think I've listened to a lot of podcasts and audiobooks and read a lot of books on this topic, where you think that just because people are going to the pub, they're great, they post on social media and drinking, having a drink's great now and again, but that isn't the form of happiness. What happiness should be is, I don't know, everyone is different. It's having that sip of coffee in the morning or going for a quiet walk, or everyone's definition of happiness is different. And it's whatever makes you you, whatever makes you happy. So I think we are in a culture, and it's, I see it as a teacher and I see it as being on social media actively, is that people are often copying other people and trying to conform to what they need to do. And again, it's trying to attain things like a house or get tangible things, you know, because when I get this, I'll be happy because I'm not enough right now. Do you feel like that people are just always looking for the next thing rather than just being happy with themselves?
Well, I think there is, you know, they say that comparison is the thief of joy. That's a phrase that I heard in recent years and it really resonated with me. But we're encouraged to compare ourselves to everyone else online, aren't we, on the internet? And that's the problem, I think, the major problem that the youth of today, he said, sounded like an old man, but the youth of today have to confront into the term is the fact that they are going to constantly be comparing themselves to what the pictures and the stories they have in their pocket on their phone, you know. And I don't know, I think we have to look for happiness elsewhere. And I talk about this a lot with clients that are dealing with their own self-worth and their own value, you know. And it's like, we judge our success on how many likes we got on our last post or how much money we have or how many things we have that we can show off, when that's all coming and going. That's all temporary. The stuff that is constant, the one thing that will remain constant no matter where we are, what phase we're in our life, I am always going to wake up as me, as Tim Box. So any effort or focus that I put into making me feel good about who I am, as opposed to where I am, who I'm with, what I own, if it all goes towards who I am I happy with the person I am, then at least I know, no matter whether life is in a good phase or a bad phase, if I've got a lot of money or not much money, etc., I know that my foundation is that I can wake up, look in the mirror and say, well, I'm glad I'm me, though, you know, because I know I might not be happy about everything about me. I might not like the way my hair looks. I might not like the way my nose looks or something like that. I might not like how I've been performing at work this week or something like that. But I'll know that I'm glad I'm me in that process. And I know that by, you know, at least caring about being me, I can make the improvements I want to make. So yeah, I totally agree. It's not about what we have. It's about who we are. That's where happiness is. Yeah.
Oh, 100%. It's about how you see yourself as a person. You know, I think a lot of people think of the metric of someone's friendship is based on how they're viewed by other people. And it's not, you know, I think a lot of people, like you said earlier, people, you know, see their self-worth and it's almost like they measure their self-worth on how many likes they get or how many other things like that. And the thing is, well, what are you doing then? You're striving for more, you know? And I think it's a really unhealthy way to do it, but I really like what you're saying. If you're happy within yourself, then that's all that matters.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we make a lot of choices from day to day, things we put our time and effort into. And I think if we can look at what we're trying to achieve with that effort, if it's something transient, then probably it's going to be fairly meaningless in the grand scheme of things. If we put it towards improving ourselves, then actually that's going to be time well invested that you'll reap the rewards of, I think. You know, that's why I know that the whole self-improvement, personal development culture, it gets a bad rap in terms of being a bit toxic at times. Yeah, I get that, because especially when we're forced to do that old hustle thing and keep going and keep trying to improve. But it is a simple fact that of all the things we could pursue and we could put our energies into, improving how we feel about ourselves, I mean, that's gold, isn't it? That will always be of value. That's an investment that will always reap rewards, I think. So, you know, so if you can do that without putting pressure on yourself and without judging yourself harshly, if you haven't got where you wanted to get to, then probably that's a win double there, I would have said, you know, it's a good combo.
You mentioned earlier that when you're experiencing anxiety in your youth, you said you didn't feel as bad because it wasn't being attached to like an illness or a mental health illness, because that wasn't kind of labeled as much then. And I've also read your work and watched your work where you think that, and you've suggested that anxiety isn't a mental illness. Why do you think that is?
Okay, so I am perfectly comfortable with those that want to categorize it as mental illness. Yeah, because I think, you know, I'm not here to define terms or to diagnose people with particular issues. But I do know that as soon as we put a label of you have an anxiety disorder, or you've now developed a mental illness, then there's a lot of preconceptions that come with that. Now, bearing in mind, what we're talking about here is our emotional responses. That's the disorder or the malfunction or the illness or whatever one is an emotional response. When you tell somebody, oh yeah, there's something wrong with you, that has an emotional impact. Yeah, so it affects the very thing you're talking about, right? If I say, you know, I've got cancer or something, me saying you've got cancer won't now make your cancer worse. Yeah, it will inform you. It might not be great news, it might be terrible news, but it won't damage you in the way that telling somebody with high anxiety, oh, by the way, you've got an anxiety disorder, that's what's wrong with you, that will directly impact their anxiety. It will directly exacerbate the problem. And also, it completely gives over the power to the illness rather than to yourself. Because we do need to at some point realize every emotional response we have is a part of us creating that response deliberately with a purpose of keeping us safe, making us happy. Yeah. Now, I'm not saying the person is deliberately becoming anxious. You know, I've been there. I really didn't want to be that anxious about that stuff. Yeah. But it was happening. But there is a part of our mind, you know, in terms of our subconscious, that creates that response as an emotional strategy designed to steer us ultimately towards happiness. As weird as it sounds, when we're experiencing debilitating physical symptoms of anxiety, it's a bit of us that says, I feel under threat, and I need to get back to safety so I can pursue happiness again. Yeah, that's what it's all about. So I think that's where the problem lies, is that it comes with repercussions to call it that. Now, I feel like I do understand why we're calling it mental illness, because for many years, you know, exactly as I thought, when why am I struggling and no one else seems to be? Am I just weaker? Am I just bringing this on myself? Do I just need to toughen up a little bit, you know? And you blame yourself for not dealing with life as well as the people around you, or certainly how they seem to be dealing with life. But this is the problem. It's that middle ground. We have this, it's just in your mind. You need to toughen up. You need to sort it out. You need to stop it. Or it's an illness. You can't control it. It's just what has you now. Yeah. But the middle ground is, yeah, we didn't ask for it. We didn't bring it on ourselves. It was experience that put us through what we're going through now. But we can change it, because this is our emotions, no one else's. And if we learn to control them better, or we learn to understand them in a way so they no longer terrify us, very quickly, we start to feel a lot less anxious about that anxiety, and we start to work with it. You know, you were saying, how did I get through the other side of it? Yeah. Because I didn't fear feeling anxious. At no point did I think, why am I so anxious? What's wrong with me? I just thought, right, I'm really concerned about this particular aspect of my life. So during the years that I felt high anxiety, at no point did I talk about my anxiety is kicking off. It triggers my anxiety. It was always like, I'm anxious about that. I feel anxious about that particular situation. You know, that party, I'm a bit anxious about whether I'm going to be able to talk to people. I'm going to be standing on my own. Just stuff like that, you know? Yeah. So it was always for a reason. And I think the danger with saying you have a mental illness is to suggest that now at any time, anxiety can strike for no reason. Yeah. And that leaves us very vulnerable, I think, you know, if that makes sense.
It does perfectly. And I think, by not labeling it as a mental illness, you're giving yourself that autonomy, aren't you, to be in control of it and use it for good. Like, how can we use our anxiety for good then? Because as you mentioned, our anxiety is just there to make sure we're not putting ourselves in danger. So how can we use it? Like you said, if we're going to a party, we're nervous about a party or a situation we're anxious about, rather than thinking, oh, this is my anxiety again, I'm just going to withdraw myself. How can we use it?
Well, okay, so the first thing to do is to kind of not shy away from that feeling, because what tends to happen is we just deal with the symptoms. right? So, oh, okay, my heart's racing. I'm feeling really, I can feel how nervous I am. I can feel my anxiety starting to kick off. And then we get anxious about how we're feeling. And this then escalates the feeling, yeah? So knowing that anxiety can't hurt you would be the first thing I would suggest, because a lot of time when we say mental illness, we're like, oh no, I'm diving deeper into my mental illness by feeling really anxious about this situation, you know? So if we just accept, right, I'm anxious about something, it's a bit of us trying to get heard about, should we be doing this? Should we be preparing for it? Should we not be going? You know, that kind of thing. Hear it and live with that feeling a little bit. If you can just say, right, I'm clearly very anxious about this party because there's no one there that I think I know previously, and the only people that are there don't really like me that much anyway, and I'm worried I'm going to have that awkward moment where I walk in the room, people look up and see me and all look away because they don't want to talk to me. Yeah, something like that. That was certainly, can you tell this is where my mind was? these are thoughts I'm very familiar with. Yeah. So my job there is to work out, okay, what do I need to do with that information? Okay, because if I'm probably fearing, you know, my challenge to my survival here, I'm going to be rejected from the tribe, I shall be cast out and the lions will get me, you know, that sort of thing. And when really, probably it isn't that big a deal. You know, it isn't probably going into that room. The worst that can happen is that nobody talks to me, even when I walk up to them and say, how are you doing this evening? They say, I don't like you, go away. Yeah, which is highly unlikely for a start. It's one of those things we tell ourselves that we know really isn't going to happen. Then what would that mean? Probably I'd go and talk to someone else. That's probably the whole repercussion of it. Even though my mind was convincing me or trying to convince me, no, it'll be the worst thing in the world. They'll all turn, point, laugh at you. Yeah. And it probably ain't going to happen, you know. So it's kind of about, I think the problem is we feel anxious and we feel like this is my anxiety flaring up, rather than I'm anxious because I'm going into a situation that warrants a bit of anxiety. Yeah. You know, I'm constantly talking to parents will ring me up and say, my son, my daughter, they're anxious about their exams. Shall I bring them to see you? And I'm like, well, you bring them to see me, they're going to think there's something wrong with them. And is there anything wrong with me? I remember being anxious about my exams.
Yeah,
because they're important. They were like the most important thing I'd ever done was my exams to see if I got into grammar school or not, you know, which my parents were really keen that I would. Best thing parents can do, say, you know what? You try your best, no matter what the result, we're still going to love you. So just do what you can. You know, for me, I was fortunate enough. My parents did say that sort of stuff to me. And I knew that it was just about, okay, what marks do I want to get? And it was just about me then. It wasn't about anyone else, you know? So stuff like that, there are reasons why we feel anxious. And if we can hear those reasons, we probably got a good answer to those problems, to those fears. The part of you telling you you shouldn't be doing this or you're not good enough, it's not trying to make you upset. It's not trying to destroy your confidence. It's trying to protect you from a potential negative experience. Yeah. And if we can recognize, yep, I hear you. And I love that you care. Thanks so much for caring so much about my happiness. But there's a bit of me now that knows that thing that happened that causes you to fear this thing, I know it won't happen again. And even if it did, I wouldn't be as vulnerable as I was in the old days. That sort of thing, you know, just being able to interact with that part of your mind. And I do think it comes from an understanding of the difference between conscious thoughts and subconscious responses. Yeah, it's our conscious and our subconscious interacting in a way that is meaningful, so we can, you know, get something good done when we have that interaction.
Yeah. I read The Chimp Paradox a few months ago, and I can't remember the author now, but I remember reading it. And there was a part in there about anxiety, and it was your conscious and your subconscious. So I think it was your chimp and almost like your rational thoughts. And he suggested that you have to box with your emotions, where it's, okay, I'm feeling this. Why am I feeling this? I'm getting worked up about this. And then your rational voice comes in and says, well, we feel it like you said, well, we're feeling nervous or anxious about this because you're going to a potentially threatening situation, but you know it's not threatening. And it's almost like that calms the anxiety right down because you're boxing it out and you're just rationalizing it.
Yeah. I think you can. A lot of people in my profession will tell you that the subconscious isn't rational. It's purely emotional and imaginative. I don't think that's the case. I think it does rational thinking perfectly fine, because everything that it's doing, everything your mind is doing, is for a reason.
Yeah.
Irrational means without reason. And every response you have built up in your life has happened for a reason. You've experienced something. You know, I'll tell you right now, the thing that caused me to have major social anxiety at one phase in my life was because at some point I experienced that thing that you see in films where there's where the main character is looking through a fisheye lens now as everyone crowds around them, points and laughs at them. I literally had that experience at school once because of something that happened, you know. And it absolutely, that's where I learned to fear the interaction of the other kids at school, because what it could end that way, and that was horrific, you know. So it's like there's always a bit of learning that drives these emotions. Okay. And absolutely right, if we can actually provide some rational answers, that bit's not, it's not our enemy. It's not trying to upset us, it's not trying to destroy us, it's actually trying to help us, it's trying to protect us. Yeah. So if we can work with it, we start to get different responses. We start to feel differently about the situations we're in.
If the fear manifests itself to such a point, you start to panic or a panic attack. I'm curious to know, what's the difference between an anxiety attack and a panic attack then?
Right. Okay. That's a really good question. It's one of those things that I literally just recorded a video on this, so it's really fresh in my mind. Oh,
brilliant.
But there's a number of differences. First off, panic attacks are recognized as a thing by mental health professionals. Anxiety attacks are not defined. So it's something that the layperson has very much started to talk about, anxiety attack. Yeah. So there's a number of reasons why we might want to differentiate between the two. Panic tends to be more visceral and immediate. Yeah. And it tends to involve a fear of an imminent, you know, am I going to die from this panic attack is the main thing. It's the fear of the attack itself. Anxiety, we tend to, people who talk about anxiety attacks, I don't like the word attack for anxiety because it suggests it's something that lands on us when actually it's something that our mind creates is anxiety, you know, it, for our well-being. So attack doesn't sound right to me there. But anxiety attacks tend to be described as the more, the buildup of lots of overwhelming situations, eventually leading to us like, that's meltdown, I can't handle anymore. We reach our tipping point, if you know what I mean. And it tends to be about certain things. A lot of the time it is about, this situation in my life is challenging. This thing that's going on is giving me problems, yeah? And it can last over a long period of time, because a lot of the time we're anxious about them because they're not easily changeable. They're not easily affectable to the point where we can just square them away and say, right, that's sorted now. And also, in purely biologically speaking, panic is adrenaline. It's fight or flight. It's run or fight. One of those two things, you know. Whereas anxiety is cortisol, the stress hormone. So it's very much a pay attention to this important situation that needs to be sorted. So there are key differences. However, there is an argument that says it don't matter what the difference is, because it's not about what we label it. It's about, what are you feeling right now? Why are you feeling that way? How would you rather feel? Yeah, it's about managing what's going on with you. And it's that danger again of labeling stuff, creating now. You know, if I say to somebody, oh, what you said, what you described as an anxiety attack sounds more like a panic attack to me. You know what they're going to do next? Straight on Google, panic attacks. And then they'll find loads of people saying about how debilitating panic attacks are. I thought I was dying. I have a panic disorder now, et cetera, et cetera. And suddenly they're creating more anxiety surrounding the idea that this is actually classed as a panic attack. And it doesn't actually matter that much. It's more important why you feel the way you feel right now. And then we deal with that reason. That's what I was suggesting.
So for someone who has experienced an overwhelming sense of anxiety, I'll call it, to the point where they avoid situations now, we've spoken about in this conversation, you know, it could be a social event, it could be things like that. How can they stop those intrusive thoughts and that fear of anxiety or that fear of panic or that fear of worry from really ruining their life?
I think when we've got to the point where the biggest thing we're anxious about is how anxious we might become at any moment. We've just basically learned that anxiety is the monster that we're trying to avoid. You know, it's like when people give us coping strategies for our anxiety. Oh, here's a breathing technique. Here's something you can do to preoccupy yourself. Here's a fidget spinner and stuff like that. It's like all you're doing there is teaching the person anxiety is to be feared. Anxiety is to be managed. When I would suggest, you know, when we talk about intrusive thoughts, that's another classic one where people are always trying to get rid of any intrusive thoughts. And that could be things like, you know, a lack of, you know, a voice telling them they're no good, they can't do this. This is, what if this happens? You won't be able to deal with that. What if that happens? You know, it's not about getting rid of intrusive thoughts. Intrusive thoughts are just those thoughts that your mind has to entertain as a human being. Now, a lot of the time, your subconscious rejects a lot of ideas without them even coming into your conscious awareness.
Yeah,
the idea of what if an asteroid hits the planet? You know, there's a bit of your mind says, I don't think we need to bother us consciously with that thought. Probably doesn't, you know, and so it just rejects it. Yeah. But if we start to question our mental process, yeah, our emotional responses, suddenly there's a bit of your mind saying, oh, I've just had this thought. Do you need to know this? Is this important? Does this mean there's something wrong with us that I'm having this thought about, I don't know, leaping off that bridge or something like that, you know? So the classic example I give is a client that came to see me who was dealing with high anxiety. And they said, on top of everything else, I'm worried that I might be suicidal. And I said, why are you worried about that? And they said, well, I was walking over a bridge the other day and I had a thought about jumping off. And I said, did you want to jump off? They said, no, it terrified me that had come into my mind. I said, well, for a start, that's a good thing then. But the point here is that's what your mind has to do. Yeah. Because if you fell off that bridge, if you thought I'll jump over that barrier, it's important that your mind goes through the process of working out what the consequences of doing that would be, because that stops you doing it. Yeah. The knowledge that I shouldn't jump off of this high thing because that'll hurt or damage me. That's what keeps us on the high thing. So we don't jump off it, you know. So your mind is constantly going through the variables, the random things as well, just so that you know not to do that. But where he was massively anxious, a bit of his subconscious had said, you know what I've just suddenly thought of? Is jumping off of this bridge. Is that, should I tell you about that? Should you become aware of that? You know, and every little thought, then every little bit of processing in the background of your mind is suddenly getting the focus treatment, you know, the torch shone on it because should I be having that thought? The job here is not to get rid of intrusive thoughts. It's to treat them for what they are. Just thoughts. Yeah. Just things that your mind does as part of the process of your brain, looking at everything in the room and navigating potential hazards and potential options. You know, there was a study done, and apologies, I can't bloody remember the guy that did it, but it was postulating the theory recently that your mind does all those intrusive thoughts things and all the random thoughts simply as a practice exercise to go through recognizing the good from the bad, the ridiculous from the real, all that sort of thing. You know, why we have really strange dreams. It's almost like we're just exercising our muscles, mentally speaking, just so that we don't, you know, we don't atrophy that skill of just, oh yeah, that's what I want to do and that's what I don't want to do, you know, that kind of thing. So all of this stuff, don't try and get rid of intrusive thoughts, because if you try not to have those thoughts, you'll always be troubled if you suddenly notice one of them. And you know what, people that aren't troubled by those thoughts, if you said to them, do you ever have thoughts like that, crazy, silly thoughts like that? They'd be like, yeah, I do. And then you'll say, what do you do about them? And they'll be like, well, I don't know, nothing, I suppose, because they don't flag themselves up as important.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because we're comfortable with them. We realize it's just part of our mind doing what our mind does, you know? So a lot of the time, as weird as it sounds, the best course of action is just to not try not to be bothered by them. Because again, you're not ill, yeah? You've just become a little bit overly concerned about what your mind naturally does anyway. And that's created a higher level of anxiety about all these thoughts, all these feelings, you know?
So do you think some practices to combat anxiety are just distractions from the bigger problem?
Yeah, some of them are. See, it's that fine line, isn't it? It's about treating anxiety like it's nothing to be worried about, but at the same time, not just trying to ignore it, not just trying to go, la, 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 I'm going to ignore, you know, that sort of thing. But we do, a lot of our strategies for coping are just designed to distract us from the way we would otherwise feel if we were paying attention to it, you know? But again, it's like that concern about something that's dangerous or fearful, you know? You know, if I think there's somebody out to stab me or something, I shouldn't just be trying to distract my mind from that. Don't think about it. Don't think about it. Well, hang on. There might be an attacker in the house. You know, if they're putting it in its most ridiculous terms, if there was somebody in the house with a knife intent on stabbing me, and I was worried about that, and somebody said, well, just distract yourself. Just, I don't know, look at the TV, watch the TV. But no, hang on. There's real danger here. And that's the problem, is that we view the anxiety as real danger. And so now any attempts to distract ourselves from it meet with the resistance of that part that says, no, this is important. Yeah, there's a bit of you trying to communicate with you that it's important. It's only if it isn't important in reality, it's only going to realize that if you listen to it first, if you say, right, I get what you're saying, well done for trying, but the good news is this is nothing that we need to be concerned about. This is nothing we need fear, because that isn't somebody with a knife, actually. It's just, you know, nothing probably, you know, things like that.
It's so important, isn't it, just to, well, focus on what you're saying there by not letting those intrusive thoughts run away with themselves and manifest, but think rationally. And I think what you said there, and I'm just thinking about it as I'm saying it, is that we often use avoidance to completely avoid a situation, not a situation, but avoid the feeling rather than, it's almost like fixing the symptom rather than the cause.
This is the thing. If we just treat the symptoms, then we're missing the point, aren't we? We've always got to find out what's the source of it, because there's only one reason you feel anxious, because your mind is pushing something important forward. And a lot of the time when it's physical feelings of anxiety, you know, so we're getting actual physical responses going on, it's because we feel under threat. We've triggered the stress response, which will happen when we feel under threat. Our job probably is to listen to the part of us that is saying we're under threat, because we either are or we aren't. Yeah. And probably we're not, because that seems, you know, 99.9% of the time we're actually not. But that part is going to keep shouting at you if you just try and ignore the symptoms and ignore the responses, because that part needs to be heard. Yeah. It's like a child that won't sleep. And so there's a monster under the bed. You know, so what do? We grab the child, run out of the house, lock the doors, call the police. There's a monster in my house. No, we say, I know there isn't. That's why I don't need to be afraid in the same way that child is afraid, because I understand this is just the fears of the child. And that's what happens a lot of the time as well. Our mind has fears based on old experiences, maybe even when we were very young, you know, things we learned early on.
What else can people do then? So obviously combating those intrusive thoughts and thinking more rationally, is there other things that people can do?
Other things, look after themselves, basically. You know, there's this thing, if you talk to people that suffer like panic attacks, you know, to give it that label again, they normally have a story of how it started, and it normally started with a little bit of self-neglect. I don't know, we had a very busy time in our life, and we went out for the weekend, we didn't sleep much that weekend, and then we hadn't eaten or we hadn't kept hydrated and stuff like that, and then our body had just done something weird, because that's what happens, you know. We've interpreted it as some kind of attack or seizure or something physical that's life-threatening, and we've panicked about it, and now our mind is on the lookout for any potential panic signs, because it felt like we were going to die. So even as we go through high anxiety times, like real challenges, you know, so for example, when your kids are doing their exams, encourage them to get a good night's sleep, to, you know, stay hydrated, eat their food, so that physically they're in tip-top condition. Because when we're in tip-top condition, when we wake up in the morning, we feel good and rested, we're a lot less vulnerable to feeling under threat, because there's a bit of us that says, you know what, I can handle life. And that's a good thing. So if you're just going to do on very base level, you know, and I'm not saying look after yourself so you can deal with those anxiety symptoms. I'm saying look after yourself so you feel a little bit better about your ability to cope. Because that will calm the anxiety. So and to be fair, whenever people say, what can I do to reduce anxiety? The one thing, like the biggest thing, that if everyone on the planet did this, I wouldn't have a job. Is just stop beating yourself up about things. Stop criticizing yourself. Stop being harsh on yourself. Stop believing that motivating yourself with self-castigation is effective, because it isn't, you know. Let yourself be you. You're improving all the time. Yep, you're making mistakes every day, because that's what human beings do. But if you stop beating yourself up when you make a mistake, you learn the lessons that need to be learned, and you just keep growing. You know, so that would be if I could, you know, Thanos it, click my fingers and something about everyone on the planet changed, it would be, you would no longer be able to give yourself such a hard time for your shortcomings, because then you would naturally grow your confidence as you went through life. You'd return to the state that we're meant to be in, which is I'm me and I'm okay with that kind of thing, you know. But so,
again, it links to the point we made at the start about people compare themselves to others and strive. And I see this in people so young, even the students I teach, they're aiming for an unattainable version of perfection, which doesn't exist. And it's always more. And that's for me, there's a link between those who are the most anxious and those who view life like that. you know, and it's worrying. It's always looking for that next thing, right? Next, I need to do this. Next, I need to be perfect at this. But if I'm not perfect at that, then what am I?
Yeah. Speaking as somebody who's been seeing clients one-to-one for the last 12 years, if you had to categorize the type of person that comes to me with low self-esteem issues, they're normally high achievers. They're normally perfectionists, and the same character trait that's driven them on to be all they can be has stopped them being happy in the process, because they're never going to be good enough. You know, perfectionism is not something that us humans get to indulge in, because we're imperfect. You know, we can't attain perfection. If I tell you something, one of my standard things that I'll say to people when they just happen to mention, I'm a bit of a perfectionist, because, you know, we say that like, we're sort of saying it's a fault, but at the same time, we're wearing it as a badge of honor, aren't we? It's like when you go for the job interview and they say, what would you say your worst trait was? And you say something like, well, I think maybe I work too hard. Or so, you know, you say something that can be interpreted, it's interpreted in a positive way. And when people do that, they own their perfectionist traits. I will normally say, oh, have I told you the story of the happy perfectionist? And they'll say no. And I'll say, that's because there isn't one. Yeah, if you decide to be a perfectionist, you doom yourself to unhappiness because it's an unattainable goal. And I think you're absolutely right. Kids get set up to try and achieve perfection because for all the reasons we've kind of already discussed, social media, all that sort of thing, you know, peer pressure. And it's like we won't be happy until we reach that finish line of perfection, and therefore we will never be happy.
Yeah. I literally got Cristiano Ronaldo's Instagram up the other day and showed like a bunch of boys in my class who all love football. So I showed them his page and I said, because they always say things like, oh, when I'm in this team, I can't wait till I'm in this team, or I can't wait till this happens, or I can't wait till this happens. I want to do this. And they're like almost like living in the future. I say, well, right, boys, it's great to have goals. It's amazing. Well done. That's amazing. Mm. But I said, look at his Instagram page. Is there one picture here where he looks sad? You're like, no. And I said, exactly. So you're going to go through life now. And it's quite a mature lesson to have. I said, you're going to go through life and you're going to have maybe struggle where you don't want to train, or you don't want to do this, or you might lose and you might feel really sad about it. Ronaldo doesn't show all that on his Instagram, but you're going to be there looking and scrolling, thinking, oh, he's got it all. He's great. And why aren't I doing that by that age? Or why haven't I achieved that then? And I think it's such an important lesson to realize, even at a young age, that a world they're going into with all this social media not telling you the truth. And if you're looking for an unachievable perfectionism, it's great to have goals. But if you're looking for unachievable perfectionism, then you, like you said, you're never going to be happy.
So, you know, my wife does a lot of mental health work because she's quite prominent in her field in terms of she formerly was a baker and now she, anyway, long story short, she has a large following online and she talks a lot about mental health now because, you know, she's trying to use the platform for good. And a few months ago, when we were in the midst of the last lockdown, and she was having a bad day and she just put something up on her social media and it was like, it was her crying, you know? And I said, why did you put that up? And she said, well, if I didn't put that up, people would think there's only those times when I'm laughing, because that's 90% of what I do is put up positive stuff and we can do it and let's smash this. But if I didn't put up the times when I genuinely didn't feel that way, that wouldn't be fair on the people that are looking to me to give an accurate representation of my mental health, because it would just be all one-sided. And, you know, and it's weird how something as unusual as seeing someone upset on the internet, you know, we don't see that, do we? Because we just see all the amazing bits, all the good bits. And people have this idea, everyone else's life is 100% positive. What's wrong with me that mine isn't? There's nothing. It's just that you're seeing everyone else's highlights and you're seeing all of your behind the scenes outtake stuff as well, you know, and it doesn't measure up. So I don't know. I think it's an important lesson that you're getting across to them there, is that it isn't all smiles. It isn't, you know, there is the journey, and that's a good thing as well. You know, there is the ups and downs, because sometimes I think we go through those challenges and they're the times we remember, because we can then kind of reward ourselves by feeling good about having got the other side of those times, you know, and done the hard yards to get there. We've earned our place here, you know, with a smile on our face, if we've done that, haven't we? You know?
But the journey, not the destination.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think is the biggest lesson that you've had from your life and the work that you do?
I saw this question on your list when you sent this over. I was like, well, there's a minor question, isn't there, for giving us the answer. And I started to think about all the different lessons that I'd learned, the little insights that I had about stuff. I think the biggest lesson that I've learned, if I had to retrospectively look at everything that I've done in terms of getting where I am in my profession, in my life, the thing that I think was the big thing that steered me now in a positive way was realizing that I can change at any time. Yeah, change is an option, because for a long time, I perceived myself as locked into a certain set of responses. Oh, this is just the way I am. And that, I think, is an integral part of the message that I put out there. If you want to call it, you know, the anxiety is not an illness kind of message, you know, that sort of thing. But it is more about whether you say it's an illness or not. The key point of it is you can change. The way you are now is not permanent. Yeah, we know about neuroplasticity, of course. We know the brain continues to learn from moment one to the final moment. Yeah. So knowing that has enabled me, has empowered me to change. You know, when I see people one-to-one, I have to work out why, when they know they want a certain change, why hasn't it changed yet? Why hasn't their mind known to do this? A lot of the time, the reason is because it didn't realize it was an option.
Yeah.
To simply change the way we feel, the way we think, the way we behave. Yeah. And yet it's happening all the time around us, you know, as we learn and grow. And we don't realize it.
So if someone's listening now and they want to get in touch with you, maybe work with you, you've got a business called The Control System. So how can they do that?
They can go to my website, thecontrolsystem.co.uk, or they can find me on YouTube, Timbox the Mind Coach. No, not the Mind Coach, Timbox Mind Coach. I thought I was Joe Wicks there for a minute. and just reach out. And I feel like if people want help about anxiety, then the first port of call I would say is just check out my YouTube channel, because I put videos up there all the time talking about the sort of things we're talking about now.
Yeah.
And I do a live every Friday just to answer questions from people. And I feel like it's great seeing clients one-to-one, but I can only see so many clients one-to-one in a working week. It's now we've got the internet. Now we've got, you know, the means to get the message out. Let's use it for good, not just for the bad stuff that causes us. So yeah, find me in some capacity online and just have a look at the videos. If it resonates then, and it does any good and it helps you, that's awesome stuff.
Thank you for coming on, mate.
No problem. Been a pleasure.